Hello, this is Bob Dobbs and Cameron McEwen with our 54th episode on analyzing my booklet on Donald Trump and the tech body. And we have arrived about page 109. If you look in the table of contents, you'll see we're at page part 3, which is titled The Global Membrane or Android Meme, Phase 1. And there's a little quote in blue, my casual oral comments, and I say, global membrane is a term McLuhan uses in 64 before his use of the phrase global theater. It's well past the global village era. And Cameron himself has blogged and found a couple of other places where global membrane is said in 62 or so, right? There's a couple of other places before the Nation magazine in 64. So the first thing I say, and I say, McLuhan predicts the Android meme. Now, we may have discussed this, but we can't remember. We haven't got time to go back and check, but it doesn't hurt to go over it again. So I'm quoting page 148 of Take Today, The Executive's Dropout, and McLuhan and Barrington Nevitt say, at electric information speeds, art and science and nature converge through understanding media. So then in blue is my... my computer screen is blue, is my oral surface talk. So I say, art is puny. Science is no better. These are Gutenberg categories, and they all converge through electronic process patterning or understanding media, which is in quotes, understanding media. That's what we do. We are art. We are science and nature, and we actually can do it. The Android meme is an artist. It knows how to mold art and matter, and we're doing science with it. Now, I say we're doing science. Is that me? I'm not sure. Or do I mean people? I don't know what I mean, but let's just say the propagation something is doing it. We're doing science with it, or putting it in the left hemisphere, say. This quotation above is an anticipation by McLuhan of the Android meme. And that's the end of that. And then in my serious column, I say, the building of the architecture of the Android meme from 1960 to 2000 went through two phases. The first phase, 1960 to 85, is presented in my article, Cloning ESP, done in 1999. And then there's a comment from me saying, this next section is from the Memoir of Prince Charles of June 4, 1987, which is found in the booklet for my first album, Bob's Meat Ecology, 1992. I took the following long quotation out of the booklet. I took the following long quotation out of the booklet, the quotation from Memoir of Prince Charles. It goes from 1850 up to 1945, but I excluded that here. That's too far back. So that's the Global Village era. We start well past the Global Village, which is 1945 to 1960. So
let me just comment about that page. We finished with 109.
Right. Now, I just want to say that I say some of the effects of this cloning process are explained by my phrase, quote, mythic stages. And then I quote from the memo, and we did discuss this memo, if you want to hear something near the end of the previous session. But now Cameron's going back over it, so what would you like to say?
Well, I just want to point out that all of this is written in a kind of historical sense.
Yeah.
So when you speak of mythic stages, you mean there's one stage and then there's another stage and another stage after that.
No, mythic stages is the after you. So the solar government is built from 45 to 60, and then the universal government from 60 to 77. From 77 to 90 is the hologram world. And that's a visible figure amidst clashing universal bureaucracies, complemented by mythic government lockdown, complements of the satellites around. So 77 to 90 is mythic government, or the mythic stages. And I define myth as a whole culture or mixed corporate media in action. However, the satellite is an extension and theorization of a whole culture. So it's a phase, and then the phase after that is what we call the Internet. And that's the Android meme.
Right. But what's interesting to me in all that is that you do get down to mythic government, where mythic is a singular.
Yeah.
And then you say myth, again, a singular, is a whole culture of mixed corporate media.
Yes.
So, but when you talk about mythic stages, you're at you have a plural.
Yeah. Now, so, what that is different mixtures of media or myth. Myth around the world, you could say first world, second world, third world, fourth world. And so those different cultural collections of media, that is their mythic stage. And I get the word stage from McLuhan's Tetrad on the Credit Card, where the credit card becomes a stage, a launch pad. You know, it's an interesting extension if you look at that Tetrad. If you wanted to quickly, if you got laws of media right beside you, grab it and we'll do it. But that's where I'm the credit card is a stage. And so uh-huh. The credit card organizes different cultures, mythic media that they use. So you know, France wouldn't allow McDonald's in there. The Arabs, they don't like a lot of what we have over here in North America. So every zone has a mythic stage within the mythic government phase, okay? And so what holds them together, every one of them has to deal with the credit card or the electronic banking world. So there's several grounds there or several frames.
Mm-hmm. Just as an aside for people, if anybody's listening to this, McLuhan always uses the word stage in different senses at the same time. So a stage can be like a theater. It can, as you were just saying, it can be like a launch pad.
Yeah.
It can be something that supports things, like, as you were saying, with a credit card. But it can also be we talk about stages through time.
Stages of apprehension was his phrase.
Exactly, exactly. So, and all of those are always in play.
Yeah.
So, one of the things that we have to try to get figured out between us as we go through all this is, for me, the interesting question is the simultaneity of stages, the simultaneity of their possibilities, simultaneity of the hold that they have, the plural contest of these things in their simultaneous availability.
Yeah.
And what you do is you tend to speak of stages. You seem to emphasize the one after another.
When I'm writing, because that's the nature of print or visual communication. Like my uh-huh. tiny note chart, what it actually is showing is way different from a flat piece of paper with the stages on them. That's visualization because the paper dictates that. I don't create an anti environment to print in the content like Joyce does in Finnegan's Wake. And maybe what you're doing, you're writing linear stuff, but you're pointing out the simultaneity, which is hard to do in a linear way. You can't not be linear
right.
in your writing.
Right. So but understand, Bob, I'm not making a criticism here.
Yeah.
What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to point to something that's very important for our mutual understanding and for the topics.
And for people who read it. Yeah, for people
Absolutely.
Who read it.
Yeah, and who listen
yeah.
To our reading it.
Yeah.
So
well, I agree with that.
I'm not trying to say, oh, Bob's wrong or something like that.
Yeah.
What I'm trying to say is that this whole question of time plural, right, simultaneity and chronological time, that's kind of at the heart of what we're doing.
Yeah.
And we just need to keep in mind as we go through this stuff that the question of how to articulate that crossing of times is always in the background.
Right. And, you know, when McLuhan died in 1981, Kenner wrote an an appraisal of McLuhan by January, the end of January, in the National Review, and he cited the anecdote. He was driving around with McLuhan, probably in the 40s, early 40s, and the mother was in the car, and Marshall says, "Mom, you have to understand that Pounce Cantos and the stuff I teach is dealing with the fact that all times and spaces are happening now." That was his basic statement to his mother. So he knew that back then, and he said it, and Kenner remembered that.
Yeah.
Had you heard that? Did I ever tell you that before?
No, but that's very interesting. I'm going to have to I'll have to go back to
Kenner's review.
Essay. Yeah.
Yeah, January 81 in the National Review, probably at the end of the month, he writes it.
Yeah. Yeah, it'll be easy to find.
Yeah, and you'll see him give that anecdote. Marshall was, quote, educating his mother. And it's a key statement showing how what he was aware of that early.
Yeah.
In the 40s.
Well, I know for sure he was. We have to remember that around 1950, McLuhan's essays on figures like Tennyson have to do with the aesthetic moment.
Yeah.
And what is at stake when he's trying to figure out what the aesthetic moment is all about is this question of time.
Yeah, and he talks about a cinematic, and he has a quote in maybe page 23 of Counterblast, 1969. He says, the movie is the one medium that contains all media.
Yeah.
That's an important statement about media. Then TV does that in a live, ongoing making process. You know what I mean? But as a Gutenberg frame, the movie movie is Finnegan's Wake or Ulysses, all times and spaces. It's got all media.
Yeah. So when you're putting your finger on a very important point there that relates to what we were saying just a minute ago, the movie puts together all of the other media, but it does so in a linear fashion. And it's just speeding up linearity.
Yeah. And framing. It's a frame.
That's exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
And is that what does Heidegger mean by frame and framing?
Yeah, for what Heidegger means by that is that the world is always articulated in some way. And what modernity is the enframing of the world in a way that puts it to use. So enframing is an articulation of the world where the frame itself is our making the world available to us.
Is that the popular statement? There's a narrative. What's the narrative here? Is that what he's sophisticatedly describing, the way cultures and people need a narrative?
I mean, there's always Heidegger would agree that there is always a narrative going on.
Yeah.
Starting in the around 1945, let's say, Heidegger started to talk more and more about language and about the question of who is it that speaks.
Mm.
So what Heidegger tried to show is that language talks. It's not that we use language. Language uses us.
Yeah.
So in framing is the attempt to use language to put the world to use. So for McLuhan, for Heidegger, God, I got to get my brain working here.
Yeah.
For Heidegger, the reason that the world is in such dire straits is that we're attempting, even in our perceptions, to put it to use instead of allowing it to put us to use.
Right. Yeah. So
he takes the phrase a step back from Schiller.
Yeah, we use the tools today to do the old job, was the line McLuhan said. You know, and we don't know. Well, McLuhan's trying to point out the tools are using us. We think we're using the tools, and when we get new tools, we do it for the old job.
Correct. And so what that means is, in 1800, let's say, it was not terrible for the world to try to speed up going from one village to another by using macadam roads or by using the railway or something like that. But when we advance into rocket ships and atomic armaments and stuff, doing the old job with the new media can be fatal.
Yeah. And, well, we did ourselves in many levels already. Many levels of fatality have happened.
Correct. Absolutely correct.
Yeah.
So, for one thing, we've lost tens or hundreds of thousands of languages, each one of which had special insights. Right? And when we've lost those languages, we've lost whole cultures.
Yeah.
And we've endangered all kinds of wildlife, endangered all kinds of plants. We've turned most of the planet into some sort of monocultural factory that is a rationalization in one way of production, but in another way is a complete loss of information.
Yes.
And so what we're doing is we're advancing into an ever simpler future, which at the end of the road is annihilation.
Yeah. So you were saying, what was the idea in there? The reduction.
Well, we got into Heidegger because you asked about in framing.
But you're talking about this process of reductionism.
Right. Notice that that's what starts the Gutenberg galaxy.
Yeah, I was just going to say we can't get out of the Gutenberg meme, the power of it.
Correct. Correct. The power of the Gutenberg galaxy is it can be seen in its very first step. Its very first step is to take the complexity of speech and reduce it to letters. And there's a tremendous gain economically and in a whole bunch of other ways in that reduction, but there's also loss. And we have not, for 2,500 years or more, we haven't paid attention to that loss. And as we make more and more and more efficiencies, as it seems, there's more and more and more loss. So it's as if human beings are carrying a sack of forgetfulness on their back, and that's getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And pretty soon it's going to drive humanity and all of the creatures that depend on humanity to its knees.
Yeah.
Or lower. And the only way to get around that is to turn around and look at the sack. And I think that's one of the things that Finnegan's Wake is about.
Yes. I remember what I was going to say. He writes in Explorations in the 50s that the printing press went around all of nature and made nature its content and manipulable, manufacturable, or industrialized it. The printing press went around all of nature and made all of nature a robot, content.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's the first devastation, which he calls the fall. He called the fall of man technologically.
Yeah. Although he later, he criticized the moralization of that.
Yeah.
Right. Because the moralization is itself a Gutenbergian stance.
Right.
So the a way has to be found to critique what has been going on that doesn't itself fall into what is being criticized. And that's a very difficult thing.
Yeah. And then you start to say something else.
Yeah, I wanted to say that the when you were bringing out the enframing of nature by the Gutenberg press, the later satellites make that explicit.
Yeah.
So the there you can see the value of your linear story. Your linear story brings out how things that have already happened become explicit.
Yes. Become figures.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I do. I lay out what's ground and what's figure in the different phases. That's what the part I'm reading from the memo to Prince Charles is about. You know, I'm using the figure ground and showing how solar government becomes figure, and then universal government becomes figure, then mythic government, and then holopathic mythic stages. No, holopathic retrievals become a phase.
Uh-huh. Let me just say one thing about holopathic worlds, plural.
Yeah.
The essence of a holopathic world is that a singular structure is universalized. So if you hone in on any little part of a hologram, you find the same thing as in every other part, and the same thing in the whole has the same structure as the minutest fragment.
Yeah.
That's what that hologram is.
Right. Let me supplement that.
Yeah.
Don Thiel pointed out that there were two phases happening in technology, synesthesia and co-anesthesia. I think I've mentioned this before.
Yeah.
And synesthesia is the mixture of the senses and the mixture of the extensions. But co-anesthesia, people don't know that term. And what it does, it increasingly, the technological situation, puts the user in the center. He becomes the director of the movie or the TV show. That's co-anesthesia. And that's the holopathic. You know, you have Klaus Schwab of the World Economic Forum being some kind of figurehead or the head of WHO. So there they are, the center of the global membrane. But every individual using digital media is in the same position. They're at the center. And they're equally as powerful, so to speak, as whatever they say the new Kissinger is. So
right.
That's the co-anesthetic process that's happening of more and more the, what is that called? I forget the term for the macro mirrors the micro, but what is that in complexity, chaos theory? What is that? I guess it's just the nature of the hologram, right? Each little bit contains the whole hologram. Isn't there a word
yes.
for that? What you were describing.
I don't know. But for me, the importance is that the world is not one thing. The being, big B being, is itself plural. So the different possibilities of being, small b, are holopathic. That is to
yes.
say that the different possibilities are all holopathic structures of possibilities in being.
Yep.
So what needs to be thought is to put in the terms that you were just using, when people are at the center of a hologram, like you mentioned Klaus Schwab, but everybody is in that same position. We have to understand that the reversal that's called for is to understand that those holograms are who we are. It's not us organizing the holograms and mastering them in some way.
Yeah, we're inside them. We are the. It's inside us. We are the holograms. Yes,
that's exactly right. And so the whole big question becomes if there is to be a critique of holograms, how are we to do that
yeah.
if we're
yeah.
always inside one? And so then it becomes a question of how do we quest within the possibilities of being to find one that allows us to be both inside and outside at the same time.
Yeah, you hear the postmodern guys, they like to they point out that you can't get outside of the environment we're in. There's no
Correct.
Outside. It's
yeah.
their way of doing it. And Finnegan's That's Wake right. is a good way to look at the outside. So on page 52, television kills telephony or telephone and brothers broil. The eyes demand their turn. Let them be seen. So the visualization of this situation, which is very strange, he attempted to show the centralizing visualization with this ridiculous, unreadable book. You know what I mean? That's, he wants to show, bring back the book, bring back the eyes. Let the eye process be seen. Because that's what yeah. everybody was doing anyways, is stuck with the Gutenberg bias.
And, well, that's true. But at the same time, he's saying that within the Gutenberg bias is already a step to the outside.
Yeah.
Just ignored.
Yes. And so,
so the Gutenberg could not work except by taking a shortcut where the outside of the shortcut is not noticed, but it's there.
Yeah, so the I found my talk at Fordham in 1998 at that Media Ecology Legacy of McLuhan conference that Lance Strait organized, and they began yep. the Media Ecology Association in that year. And I was listening to myself, and I said, wow. And so I was pointing out that the satellite floated around all the old media, analog media, which was where the characters in the global theater were all the older media before the satellite. And there's this satellite, cybernaut kind of, the satellite, the floating around and outside of the planetary mix, the mixed media mix, is the co-anesthetic process more and more. So you're not outside going around the planet. That's an erroneous visualization. But the digital thing is putting you outside by putting you in the center. So the first centering was the Internet Web 1.0, where you could communicate anybody visually with email and that, and text. But YouTube, Web 2.0, allowed you to broadcast, be beyond the visual media. And so you're more in the mixture of media and in the center point. So that's like the more advanced, the more homeopathic phase, which Theo called the co-anesthetic. See, you get this point. The co-anesthetic is very important. Everybody knows about synesthesia, but they don't know about co-anesthesia. They're putting us in the center, which is nowhere. And the more you understand that, then that's the outside position. And you're floating around, like originally the satellite, around the planet and its media. But it then shrinks, disappears, and becomes an invisible cyberspace, and you're in the center of it.
Yeah. So, but the U needs to be in quotation marks.
That's because, said, yes.
It disappears.
That's the five bodies. The U is the five bodies.
Mm-hmm. What I hear you saying in terms of Don Thiel is that the move from synesthesia to co-anesthesia is a pluralization,
yeah.
right? So that synesthesia seems like it's a singular. It's the bringing together of the senses. It's what we always do, no problem. But as soon as you look at co-anesthesia, then you understand that that putting together of the senses is not one thing.
Yeah.
It's a whole series of possibilities that you do, but only by raising the question of who the hell this you is.
Right. Now, let me, what do I say? But I try to explain. That's the meaning of homeopathic. So let me see. Do I include that phase in my quoting? Let's see. I got the mythic government. Then you go down to, I make some commentary. So I say, my new discovery is I came up with the phrase homeopathic cliche probes. This is my casual talk. It's important to find out what this means because I'm later going to say a homeopathic cliche probe is a meme. And I say as it gets thinner and thinner and more of a software pattern, it's less a hardware product and becomes an image or a meme. Someone was telling me recently, quote, Well, memes are these old cliches that the kids talk, you know, regain, re-grab them, some stupid image from the 60s TV or something, and they hang it, slash it around as a meme. It's a cliche being reused as a probe, and it's tiny. I had the term right there in 1987, holopathic cliche probes, and they're the later phase of the mythic stages, the holopathic cliche probes. Mythic stages were the first bigger memes in a slower time, the 70s and 80s, the beginning of digital memes. McLuhan anticipated the memes, which are digital memes in Android. And then I say, then I explain.
What page are you on, Bob?
Page 111 going into 112. I'll let you catch up. Take a look at that, what I just read.
No, I see where you are now.
So then I say, you know where holopathy comes from? That's the shrinking global theater, which is actually the effect of a hologram, which comes through, quote, the word that makes the market in the American White House. People knew there was one issue in 1968, quote, Vietnam, we've got to do something about it. And I said, that's a hologram or news event. But then it keeps shrinking, 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 homeopathically, because in homeopathy, the substance gets tinier and tinier and tinier, but it still has the memory of the substance. That's the theory. Then it keeps shrinking, shrinking, shrinking homeopathically over the next 40 years until you've got little kids bigger than the global hologram. That's the result of the holopathic cliche probe. So I don't say that. That's bigger than the global hologram. That's them co-anesthetically becoming the center more and more, or a diluted center or an illusion visually. So that's what I think I'm trying to say there. So then I say, since there's nothing but replays, remember, quote, the obsolescence phase, the second phase of extension, is a cliche, and then retrieval is the third phase. To make a cliche.
1 minute. Hold it.
Yeah.
But what you say there is very important. You say, since there's nothing but replays, right? So that means that the historical stages that you're talking about are not one thing after another thing. They're all replays.
Overlaying.
That's right. So they, at the same time that there's an east-west or horizontal plane being discussed here, there's also a vertical plane.
Yeah, with depth.
So that's a very good sentence there. Nothing but replays, remember. The obsolescence phase is a cliche. So that's excellent. I agree with that 100%.
Okay, great. And so I'm quoting Howard Gossage's essay in McLuhan Hot and Cold by Stern, and where he says, the new technology is the last word, and then we use it and get familiar, so it becomes cliche, and then it becomes art form, and then it becomes archetype. I'm glad I read that back in 67, 68. That's an important four steps that he lays out, and you never hear anybody using it. And so
we need to think that vertically, not just horizontally.
Yes, yeah. So that's what I mean by the obsolescence phase. I think I explained that earlier. I quote the Gossage thing. So I'm referring back to it. The obsolescence phase is the cliche, and the retrieval is the third phase. To make a cliche work, you've got to dress it up differently. How you dress up the retrieval is an action of probing, which McLuhan described as, quote, feeling around, looking for some new situation. He's retrieving. He's replaying. When jazz was obsolescence, they brought in the cliche of tribal drum music, dressed it up with Elvis, a white guy singing it, Elvis Presley, and called it rock and roll. Elvis was a cliché probe. Another aspect, when you read the book From Cliché to Archetype, McLuhan tends to say, quote, archetypes are contained, stable things, end of quote. They are like books, I say. Archetypes are what literate people come up with. Tribal people are constantly changing and moving around. They're a cliché, and the cliché is not stable and concrete like an archetype. It's always being improvised, slanged, and generally how your black comedians act when they're probing. You know, Negro comedians, whatever else they call them, African Americans. A cliche is more a probe, more an exploratory expression than an archetype. And that's what he says in McLuhan says in his book. And then the more you become aware of pop culture, depending on how old you are, definitely the probe of rock and roll in the 50s and 60s sounded to adults like it's all the same noise in quotes. Whereas to the kids, it was 50 kinds of snow, which is the old line Carpenter talked about, Eskimos. They could see 50 kinds of snows, where we didn't see anything. We just saw white, or now called the Inuit. Whereas to the kids, they can see the shades and nuances and levels and depth in the rock music, in the noise. So to the kids, it was 50 Kinds of Snow, and they'd argue over different bands. But, quote, the dull ears of the literate parents couldn't hear the differences. So then you have to include the dull meaning of cliché. That's what rock is for parents. But it also has to have a sense of newness. That's the probing part. McLuhan, McLuhan pick up the parents pick up the cliché part, the dull part, and the kids pick up the new part. That's nice.
The opposite is also true.
Because right? New becomes old becomes new, as he says in Take Today. It flips.
But one thing we have to notice is that when you say that archetypes are contained stable things, they are like books.
Yeah.
That's only one view that McLuhan had of the archetype.
Yeah, that's the Northrop Frye view.
Yeah, so that's right. So for McLuhan, an archetype, like a ground, is inherently reversible.
That's
so
right.
And in
Sidney's classroom, he says a cliche and archetype are interchangeable.
Correct. So it belongs to an archetype to express itself, and when it expresses itself, it's a cliche. And a cliche is something that always points beyond itself, and when it points beyond itself, it's an archetype.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's very important to say that. I don't say that. I keep the literate division. But, yeah, the flux of them is what Joyce is showing in Finnegan's Wake. And
resonance.
Yeah, this is the key for people. They freeze on archetypes in their identity quest, and they get into mysticism, Gnosticism, or Catholicism or something. They retrieve Gutenberg's soul, came from Augustine, and they're trying to retrieve that archetype. They don't get the flux of the identity process now. That's the challenge to the Gutenberg effect, is to see that the archetype is not solid like that anymore.
Correct. That's for McLuhan. There's several words for that.
What are they?
One is tactility that you often use, but another word is electric.
Yes.
Electric is the flux between poles.
Right. It's not a flow. Another version
back
of...
Back and forth.
Yeah, it's the back and forth, and it's the overlay, it's the interpenetration. It's hard to visualize what electricity is.
That's right. And I'll just point out here that when McLuhan took one of his first philosophy courses, this would have been in 1930 or 1931, he took it from a philosophy professor at the University of Manitoba called Henry Wright. And Henry Wright wrote a book in 1926 on the foundations of democracy. And McLuhan read this book very, very closely, annotated it over and over and over again.
Have you seen it?
Yeah, it's in his library at Toronto.
Right.
So,
Vera Fisher book.
One of the favorite words of Wright in this book is intercommunication. And McLuhan uses the word intercommunication the rest of his life from that book.
Right.
And intercommunication is what we're talking about here between cliche and archetype, or between
tactility and electricity.
Pole.
That's the third term.
Yep.
Tactility, electricity, and intercommunication.
Yeah.
And you see Croker, his way of talking about it is interpenetration and interpellatio. I don't know if he got them from postmodernist guys in France or something, but he has other words that they came up with, which are talking tactility. You know? They have other ways of doing it. Maybe imminence is another one. The imminent, you know, not imminent coming soon. It means pervasiveness, interpenetration.
Mm-hmm. All words can be used within the Gutenberg galaxy, or an attempt to escape the Gutenberg galaxy, or within the Marconi era. No single word captures what it needs to be said.
Yeah, there's, I don't know, maybe I saw it in Roland McHugh's Annotations of Finnings Wake, where, you know, a clown or somebody is holding three or four balls, and one's always slipping out. So he's always grabbing the ball that's slipping out, and then he gets it and brings it into the three, but the other one becomes the fourth and falls out. That's our perception under this changing ground situation. We can't hold it all. Do you see what I'm saying?
That's the human condition right there.
Yeah.
The human condition is to be finite. We only have so much time. We only have so much brain power. We only have so much attention. So when we are looking at one thing, we're not looking at other things. And those other things are always escaping us, and they can be critical.
Right. So you get poise. If you know you've got four things and you're catching three, you know you can't get the fourth, then you accept that resonant interval or the incompletion of what you're perceiving. That's the clue. Now, that process of always fumbling and not keeping it all, it became an environment electrically.
Right.
The electric environment, or later the Android meme and the tech body, do that. They present it to us. And so our incompleteness in handling this is slat overlaid on us, and that's where I get the quadrophenia. So our basic schizophrenia or incompletion then gets overlaid by the environmental schizophrenia. So you got two of them, so that's where quadrophenia comes. Then you can have different ways of breaking down, like the five bodies or the Android meme. But to understand the clown figure trying to hold all the balls is a very good image.
What do you mean by saying that the tech body brings the incompletion to the fore, I think you said?
Okay, so you have the chemical body has its life and it's finite and it's always a little behind what's going on. Now, sometimes they have mastery for a minute or two, then there's always something slipping out of their control. And
right.
part of the skill of living is to accept that you're not getting it all. So you don't become a nut trying to impose a pattern on somebody, because your pattern's always going to be incomplete. So you allow the other person to actually fill it in for you, what you didn't get to say. You know what I mean?
Right.
Mm-hmm. So there's a complementarity there. That situation between the chemical bodies became externalized as the electric environment, radio, TV, movie, and the whole thing, as the global theater. And then it started to get shrunk, so everybody has that that failure to frame it all in their cell phone, and they're looking at it, and they're trying to figure out how to frame the news or frame the information that's coming in. And they don't recognize, no, that environment is not going to complete it for you. It's the same mirror of you, a miming of your cognitive, your drama of cognition. And so it's inside you and you're inside it. So you got two dramas of cognition. You got the natural first nature or chemical body one, and it's interplaying with the chip body, TV body, or Android meme drama of cognition.
Mm-hmm. I understand what you're saying, but what I don't understand in a part of what you're saying is you were using the word acceptance, and you were saying,
when you know you can't get it. I remember reading in Kool-Aid Acid Test that Leary, Ken Kesey and them, they get on their group LSD trips and all that, and they would get closer and closer to getting it all. It all like implode into a big epiphany. But they never could get to the final sense of completing the epiphany. And they had to recognize the LSD will make me think I'm getting closer and closer, and I've got to step back from that feeling because I'm not going to get there. That's what they learned. So
that's
an example of how you have to live.
That's right. But it would be still Gutenbergian and still tragic. If people think that the great need is to sort of accept one's finitude and to understand that one can't know it all, can't organize it all, and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
That
That's limited. You know, and a friend of mine, an older guy, once told me, he said, Bob, you can understand the non-understandable. And that's an important point to get. You get glimpses of mastery of it temporarily.
But it's not just that we're unable to grasp it. The great problem is that we are subject to forces. This may be where you're getting to with the tech body.
Yeah.
We're subject to forces where somebody can be entirely in a position of acceptance of their own finitude and of their own inability to organize everything and all this sort of stuff, and they can be blown up, right? In war, they can get cancer, or they can be going around in a great bubble of acceptance and hurting their own children in some way.
Yeah, that's a kind of repression. Yeah, that's accepting a definition of yourself, a limitation.
Yeah, so the calling of human beings isn't to self-organize that eventually amounts to a self-organization that admits that there's something else to the world. Right, that admits that it can't organize everything, doesn't know everything, and sort of that's what the self is or something. But no, beyond that sort of self-organization that claims not to organize everything.
Yeah, the phrase is arguing for your limitations.
That's right. That's a kind of inframing.
Yeah,
that is a Gutenbergian goal.
Yes.
You know, it's like the Caspar David Friedrich painting of the wanderer at the top of the mountain, and below him is the fog and clouds, so that there's no problems up there. There's no ant-like people below him. There's just him on the mountaintop. That's that kind of Gutenbergian
perspective
that includes what can't be seen because the fog is there.
Yeah.
Right? That still is entirely Gutenbergian.
Right. So that's due to the book enhancing the matching, and the book makes you think, it's a delusion, that you can get to a conclusion with a period. That's what it enhances, that sensory bias.
It's the bias that makes possible the book, not the book that makes possible the bias.
Right. So the making process that is before the book and after the book under electric conditions, you can get pattern recognition, which is what McLuhan called the third Copernican revolution, is you actually can enjoy the mind coming to conclusions. It's like we do it. We get insights. We get excited by a pattern, and that's there as a sensory pleasure, but it'll fall away.
Yep.
That's what you have to recognize. You know, it's going to fall away. But you can enjoy the sensation of thinking you got it all.
Right, and each one of those things is a hologram.
Yes. Yeah, it contains everybody and you flipping back and forth. You flip into the many, and then the many flips into the one. Which is what, let's see if I come up with that part. Just going down here. Mythic stages. I've got to get to the homeopathy. I must explain that. Where is that? I'm scrolling down.
Where are you now? 113?
116. 116.
You're going by a lot of stuff there, Bob.
Yeah, but I'm trying to find that part of the explanation of the homeopathic phase, and I may not have included that. I will just search homeopathic, see where it goes. So there's that. Yeah, I have here, I actually do have it. It's drug taking too, but it's a combination with the hidden operations of the computer, like the previous environment was the hidden television.
And where are you?
Okay, it's 110 in the blue part after I talk about mythic government.
Yeah.
And so near the bottom of the blue part. Then all the there's hidden television, and it's accompanied by the computer is the hidden thing. It's accompanied by laser beams and genetic engineering. Then all that becomes a visible hologram, which is on the way to becoming holopathic amidst the clashing visible bureaucracies, complemented by the hidden landscape, which is the mythic government. And what's myth? It's any mixture of media that a culture thinks it represents. And I think that's where I don't go any further. It's, let me just try this. Holopathic, cliche probes, a little further down. I did that. Holopathic. 112. 150. Okay, do I go way down there? Later on page 150, I say holopathic is a word that combines the two processes of homeopathy and the hologram. Since the technologies of the industrial and subsequent electronic revolutions have been subsumed by the burgeoning television environment after 1945, one might as well say that, quote, everything had disappeared. However, in homeopathic terms, one should understand that everything, or at least the memory of everything, was being diluted to ever more invisible, inaudible, but potent effect, capital letters. This is a proven homeopathic principle. See Benveniste, who was a friend of Baudrillard, and I talked to Baudrillard about Benveniste. He's the guy who proved it in 88 in Nature magazine. Then Randy and the skeptics went after him, wrecked his lab. Really hurt him. And this memoried everything was inhabitable environment as far as human beings were concerned, even though only one-third perceptible to them, because the effects of an environment always precedes its causes. Hence the use of the term hologram. Since most everything was being retrieved, there's your endless replays, there was a necessarily archetypal quality to the situation. Also, since it was an ever-changing and ever-fluid context, there was a complementary process of intensity creating the holopathic cliché probe. And that's the alchemy you've lived in from 1986 to 2012. These holopathic cliché probes constitute further refinements of the form and content of the newspaper, movie, radio, television, and computer environments, and their interpenetrations of each other under the panoptical surveillance scanning of the satellite environment. Advertising and the Nielsen ratings were the gluons, subatomic particle, that simulated economic control of these media meetings. So then, do I need to say that part? Do I continue? Moving down past the blue part, our communication environments from the printing press on were layered over and through our older linguistic environments. Humans
are
were,
you still up at 150, or are you back?
Yeah,
at,
I'm continuing from 150. I'm down getting near 150.
Okay.
I'm on 151.
Okay, we have to remember that we're skipping over 40 pages here.
Yeah, I'm just trying to find the part where there's a point about the holopathic I want to describe. So let me see, where is that? So I'm going down. I have the holopathic cliche probe on page 152 becomes a digital meme. And then I say, however, other portions of the Android meme underwent massive decentralization and splayed effects of the phase two of the Android meme, which constitute a huge replay of phase one of the Android meme as content, in brackets, holopathic cliche probes. McLuhan anticipated the holopathic cliche probe with his use of the module. So I quote McLuhan doing the module. And that's the last place where holopathic. And so I say, I had to come up with something that is like a meme, holopathic cliche probe. No one knows what that means, so I had to find old words, and I did. I can't make the – okay, there it is. And these two paragraphs explain module. So then I go down, and I get into the mini module. That's McLuhan's terms. And I say that's intuiting the holopathic meme. So – I don't get to because when I did this in 1987, Rush Limbaugh and the 90s and 2000 never hadn't happened yet. So what you had, who became powerful in the retrieved simulation of the radio environment was Rush Limbaugh. And then you had Clinton, who was taking the White House and being inflated to incredible levels. So what you had, the world started to see what McLuhan said in the 60s, future wars will be two generals having a duel. And they'll represent, you know, whole complex media nations and other media mythic stages. But the point is that more and more the individual getting co-anesthetized and being at the center is the holopathic environment. So you have battles between holopathic cliche probes. That's George Soros versus Bernie Sanders, or Rush Limbaugh versus Clinton. All these figures that they became huge. You understand how they became huge in the 90s and in the internet period? We were watching the creation of generals who were going to have duels. You follow that?
Well, I mean, if I were to say what I hear you saying, I would simply say that the holograms are different ways of living in and envisioning and understanding everything.
Yep.
So that all. And each one of these is a possibility that is prior to humans and that organizes humans, not vice versa. So as you were saying, humans are at the center of these things, but not at the center as in a control room. They're in the center as being controlled.
Yes, and thinking they're at the center.
That's right. So when these things are at the same time holopathic, that means that the we've come to a stage in human history where the biggest things of all have become visible and have become something that in a certain way we understand so that we can use their power. But when we do so, we only endanger ourselves because we, as you were just saying a second ago, we confuse the idea of our controlling with our being controlled.
Yes.
So we confuse active and passive.
Yes. So now, why do they say in the internet the first really dominant meme and content inflation going on was conspiracy theory? All the guys who had a certain pattern recognition, they didn't know it. It was holopathic. And they started to see that the Rothschilds or the Rockefellers or the Antichrist was running everything. I'm calling that a holopathic central Web 2.0 experience. So everybody was potentially the Antichrist, the guy running everything. And so In pop culture, you had Michael Jackson, a massive phenomenon, and then Madonna, and then whoever came after them, Beyonce and all these people. That's in music. And then you'd have a dominating person in Hollywood for a while, and all media would be around them. Movies we made about whatever that actress is that came from Friends. She was Brad Pitt's first wife, Brad Pitt and Angelina. More and more, now this is queen for a day, but in the holopathic phase, Angelina Jolie had to work with the United Nations, go to Africa and feed people and be a Mother Teresa. They had to be the saint. They had to be the counter to the holopathic Antichrist. So more and more, we were up against people making $500 million like Rush Limbaugh or Joe Rogan or Howard Stern. More and more, we centralized and imploded into icons. And so people looked like they were more and more fans and dupes and part of these Hollywood cults, while their actual life was they're all over the place in their Web 2.0 broadcasting and commenting And then Trump epitomized that even more extreme. The whole world overreacted to Trump, right? So he was a major homeopathic completion there. And then the tech body comes in after that or underneath that. So you're saying that we move beyond collectivities, which were solar government, universal government, mythic stages. Now individuals were at the co-anesthetic center, and they were what we were battling against. But what all the Matrix members were forced to think about. You see, that's what I'm saying. The homeopathic super angelization of, quote, an individual chemical body, even though they're made up of five bodies and are everywhere in everybody's hair and all, and in everybody's body. You see what I'm saying?
I follow the narrative, excuse me, and it makes sense to me, but you used the phrase, we are battling against. That I don't understand.
We are battling the homeopathic king.
Who's the we?
All the people who are super angelic homeopathic centers themselves, who are ready to take over from Joe Rogan and be the center position in the android meme, to be
the dominant figure. Yeah, so what you're saying there is that the next appearance of the hologramic control center is every human being at every moment being at the center of these things, seemingly in control and being in no control.
Right. And you notice, I don't think they asked Marilyn Monroe back 60 years ago how she would solve the world's problems. She would have
probably did.
Yeah, but to give a little puny opinions. When you get to the Rush Limbaughs and President Clinton or other cultural singular holopathic, quote, antichrist or leaders of the United Nations, they were required to be comprehensively tetrad managing everything. They had to know about everything that was going on, all the problems.
Right.
So that Greta Thunberg, that little kid who became a Green Deal monster a few years ago, that's an example of a holopathic process there. They hoiked up this little girl, and she went around telling the Pope and everybody to get their shit together, right?
Right. So if I understand you correctly, what you're doing is you're bringing together hologram, which is everything.
Yeah.
Every hologram is the whole universe according to a single structure.
Right.
Holopathic is the infinite miniaturization of that possibility, suddenly it becomes apparent to everybody, not so that they notice, but it's right in front of their face, that every way of structuring the entire universe is now before us as a tiny little element, a tiny little gene that we understand as generating those holograms.
Yeah, which I call in the chart the quark tune. You're a quark, and for most people, you're absurd and hilarious. So, Nancy Pelosi's a quark tune. So another aspect of the holopathic is the quark tune phenomenon. And let me just say that next thought was, just a second. I was holding it there while you were talking. The next thing to say about the homeopathic, you have the after image of chemical body social structure. So another meaning of the shrinking to the tinier is you get lower and lower people down in the social scale, the social hierarchy of industrial society or literate society. So more and more, the bottom of the world social system becomes queen. Like there was this lady in Ecuador, Bolivia. She led the peasants, she was peasant to extreme, like nowhere, come from a little starving village. And she became a huge icon in South America, representing some movements and populist thing.
Mm-hmm.
But
she's
from the most poorest situation. So that's another part of the shrinking. As you go down to the bottom more and more, and they become significant. And that's part of the social justice warrior, Black Lives Matter, the victims matter, the welfare mother is a queen, and everybody should give them a job. You see that part of the chemical body social structure of the tiniest and the most insignificant becoming super powerful, at least hogging the mediascape, the android meme.
Yeah. So for me, what you're doing there is that you're trying to articulate a whole new scientific field or fields, plural.
Yes.
If we look at the physical world, you can have a mountain, or you can have a whole weather front, or a hurricane, or something like this. And we know that at the basis of these things are microscopic, or smaller than microscopic, subatomic particles.
The chaos butterfly is an expression of that.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
So what you're saying, I think, is that something like that is true of the interior landscape of the world of human experience.
Yeah.
All we know at this point is how to use the partial intuitions we have of this, which we use to make corporations or to wage wars or to utter propaganda or something like this. We do not know how to articulate what in fact we're doing. And
right.
You are, if I understand you, you're trying to say, I'm trying to tell you how to look at this
yes.
stuff that is aside from how you're captured.
Yes, exactly. And I just thought of this image. A cliche of our time is to see a fan, a little god in there with their cell phone, but they don't understand they are, and they bump into a celebrity. They even have stood in a lineup to ask questions or get autographs, and they, when they actually meet the chemical body, they get stunned. They become speechless. And later they say, what the hell is wrong with me? Why couldn't I say anything? Because they're seeing, it doesn't make sense what they're seeing, because with the multi-body spaces, infinite spaces, that's what the star is. But when you meet the chemical body, it doesn't make sense. This little fucking body here is this huge thing that I live inside of, and my dreams revolve around. Now, that's probably always been the case in show business, but people are more and more stunned by encountering in the chemical body this multi-bodied homeopathic cliche probe that you think is at the center of everything, and you use to keep yourself from being aware of being at the center of everything.
That's right. That's right. So if you just think of the difference in men's hairstyles between, let's say, 1950 and now, if somebody were on YouTube and they actually combed their hair, it would look absurd.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Whereas in 1950, you had to use Brill cream or something.
That's right. And you know, Ion jokes about either Bernie Sanders or Boris Johnson. He says they comb their hair with a balloon. And you look at Boris Johnson, how messy his hair is.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. So these people are puppets of what you're talking about.
Yes, this incredible squared tactility quartoon cubed is what's going on. And so they don't have the normal visual proprietary or proportions or sensibility. Like Ian says, my mother knew you had to have sensible shoes, okay? And I remember my mother being shocked when everybody started wearing sneakers in the 70s. She said, what the hell's going on? That's gym equipment. You don't wear that out in society. But everybody started wearing sneakers, and that was shocking to her. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's the losing of visual order that she was – numbed by. But anyways, it's so ridiculous the way people are now. The way they look. And another homeopathic cliche probe is the Kardashians, right? These ridiculous people who have big bums and they become iconic global multi-universe shapers for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And where did she come from? Her father was the O.J. Simpson trial guy. You know what I mean? And so you get – now there's a – there. Remember, what's his name at Atlantic Monthly? Lewis Lapham. He – when he says when he saw the crowd he's celebrating the white car that O.J. was in and escaping through L.A. on the highway. And, and Lewis Lapham said, I saw this – new pagan reality. These millions of pagan idiots, you know, totally hypnotized and cheering on O.J. Simpson. He says, that's when I realized McLuhan was on to something. And he and what I'm saying is he does the preface to the MIT reissuing of Understanding Media in 1994-95 in there, and he cites the O.J. situation as his epiphany. That, oh, actually something has changed here. The people are different. And McLuhan was on about this, and us literate snobs in New York thought he was wrong or ineffectual or not right. But that's a holy passy cliche probe, O.J. Simpson. Right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Let me just plug my diagrams for a minute, or my figures. What they try to do is they try to present holopathic possibilities that can generate hologrammic worlds.
Now, who tried to do that?
That's what I'm trying to do with my little diagrams.
Yeah, you're trying to visualize or do something on the holopathic cliche pro principle. So you've realized what you're trying to do.
Correct.
Good. And so then you were saying, so knowing that...
I can't get anybody to actually do it, right? As soon as they put pen to paper or start using a drawing program on the computer or something like this, something grabs them and they can't do it.
Yeah, because so then you see the evolution of painting. So you get abstract expressionism. They're trying to deal with the electric tactility of the radio era. Then Pollock comes along in the TV era, and all he can do is try to express the visual inexpressible, the intangible, is drip paint on a canvas, right? You see the arts trying to visualize in the old visual medium of art, and of course it fails, and then it flips into Andy Warhol just holding up a canned soup or some manufactured package, which is the old mechanical environment, as art form.
Mm-hmm.
While being in a factory, a software factory, processing people who come by and get interviewed on his little TV camera, he was miming what was going on that McLuhan was describing.
Well, that's true, but they notice what can we say? That there's always a reverse current going on.
Yep.
So it's true that Warhol captured the
media
market.
Processing. Media processing.
Yes. However, when the abstract expressionists were going about their business, and when that got reduced to just dripping.
You know where it became? In Warhol's time, the retort to Warhol was concept art. That's what happened in the 60s at the same time as Warhol. Warhol was minimalism and conceptual art, right?
That's right.
That was another kind of abstraction.
That's right. But what was going on with those artworks, unknown to them, and what we're trying to do, but in a more conscious way, is they were attempting to find a way to articulate
The diagrams that you're making.
Well, that's right. Or you could say the holopathic seeds that you are explaining the genesis of.
Right. And Marshall's word for it was module, the increasing modular.
That was one of his words.
Yeah. It's not a used word. So I found that was the word and the way he uses it in Ecclesia archetype, that's the closest to a meme, a tinier shrinking meme that I could come up with, because I was trying to keep McLuhan in the game and find stuff that he was keeping up with the changes.
Mm-hmm. Well, the main word that he used in the last 20 years of his life for this is simply structure.
Yeah, yeah. And figure ground? Saying figure ground as a gestalt thing? Gestalt structure?
Yeah, when he was having his long interview with Nina Sutton, he said that when he found figure ground, that became the dominant, I don't want to say figure again, but the dominant theme of his work.
Theme of structure.
Was figure ground from 1964 on.
Yeah.
He read about figure ground just months after he finished Understanding Media.
Yeah, and he wasn't happy with hot and cool.
No, well, it had obvious limitations, sure.
But, you know, this, you're saying he started relying in the end on structure. That's not structuralism, you know. It might be something like post-structuralism, but his use of structure was a convenient world to say there's something here that is thicker, deeper, denser, and figure ground was the other explanation of structure. But you see what I'm saying? Structure was a word that resonated all kinds of things to people, so it was useful.
Yeah, so structure for McLuhan is another way of articulating medium.
Yeah, and this homeopathic odd thing, it's hard to be a tactile eye. It's hard to have visualized tactility. Oblique.
It's equally hard to have oral, O-R-A-L or A-U, tactility. Tactility is inherently both oral and auditory.
Yeah, and it's empty. There's no content.
Yes.
So, what did I just say there a second ago?
Well, it has no content, but it has all content.
Yes. And I said a word there, right there just before you went into figure ground. Forget what I said. The structure, tactile eye, the verbum. You ever seen his tetrad on verbum?
I've seen it, for sure.
We've talked about it before, but there it is.
Yeah.
He was verbing. He's being a verbum. He was grunting. You know what I mean? His word structure was a final grunt, which contained all possible frequencies and intonations and vibrations in it. That's the word making the market. The grunt makes the market. Now, that became figure, first with Trump, who couldn't finish his sentences, and then Biden couldn't finish his syllables, right? They were getting more and more grunt. And then Biden ends up walking around looking for someone to shake hands with, but everything has disappeared, so there's nobody there for him to have an audience with.
Mm-hmm. But when you talk about stuff like this, Bob, do you think that there's some sort of progression going on that's actually progress, or just
no? It's not progress. It's just more intensity. It's what is that phrase? Some people use the word and. There's this situation and the end is what's coming. Further refinement of the Baroque spiral thing you're inside of. That's shrinking and miniaturizing. The and, it's italicized.
Right. So when you talk about this stuff, do you see yourself sort of in this maelstrom heading down and you don't know where it's going? Or do you see yourself as seeing a way out that you need to explain to people? Where do you locate your narrative?
I think McLuhan, you'd walk along with McLuhan and he'd be constantly talking and describing what you're walking through, right? Couldn't shut up. I see myself that way in the radio show. So people call up. We're having a journey where we're playing music, talking, and callers, and all this stuff, and Ion's doing his thing, and it's sort of a cacophony. But we're sculpting it. We're paying attention and correcting as it goes along. And so somebody will call up and say, "Bob, I have no idea what you're saying, but I totally agree," and I agree with them. You know what I mean? And so you include the nonsense that we don't know what the hell we're doing, but we seem to be making great progress in the moment, making patterns. Yeah, that sense of the absurd is always going on. So I'm always laughing while people are getting turned on to what I'm saying, because I know it's not working, or it's ineffectual, or it's incomplete. But it doesn't appear that way in the moment. I guess that's like jazz, you know, improvising. They're going along making shit up and making noise, but they think they're getting somewhere, or that they're creating beauty.
Yeah.
So
you know that I appreciate this aspect of you.
Yeah.
Because we've often talked about it.
Yes.
At the same time that there's this very funny, very in the moment guy with a sense of the absurd. There's also the sense of this guy who's so dedicated to dialogue that there's no idiot, there's nobody dead, there's nobody that isn't even born yet that you won't talk to.
Yeah, that's right. That's the everything. That's the everything.
That's right.
And I'm also, quote, pedantic. I'm insisting on something to be understood. That's funny. You know what I mean?
So you're sort of, if I can imagine you for a moment, I see you in the control room of a radio station, let's say.
Yeah.
But the radio station is within a rocket ship, and the rocket ship is exploding in all directions.
Yeah.
Right, and you're sitting there with your headphones on, talking,
ignoring the explosions.
That's right.
Yeah. Claiming all is well, I'm making total sense, and everybody should be getting it. That's exactly what goes on. And then what?
That's right.
And I had fun doing that for years, but at the end of 2000 and. By March 2009, I finally was on a station with a guy who would let me talk for 55 minutes. So I went from July 2008 to March 2009. I had 55 minutes every week, and I got to say everything. I got it all spelled out, explained everything. It took 9 months, and I knew I had nothing more to say. And fucking luckily, Ion showed up. So, yes, I'm there in the control room talking, but it's got this other voice that can't stop babbling. You know what I mean? A parallel babbler. And he took over filling in the content that I needed at that time.
So where was this radio station?
It's Achieve Radio. It's Achieve Radio. It's what we're on now. What happened is that James, a guy in L.A., had a show on some right-wing station that was run by a Minuteman kind of guy, you know, a survivalist down in Texas or someplace. So James got on there. And then I came on saying stuff that this military right wing and his audience had no fucking clue what I was talking about. But what was funny, I can't seem to be making sense. And he was a friend of Ron Paul who was running for president. This is in the spring of 2008. And he said, "Bob, I know you're on to something. We've got to meet with Ron Paul. You've got to tell Ron Paul what you're telling him. This is what he needs." Because he was failing on the media charisma level. You remember that? Ron Paul had the popularity and the numbers, but he just didn't have the image or the charisma of a Clinton or something. So he was always trying to get Ron Paul to listen to him, but the people around Paul wouldn't let call him John in, and so we never got there. But I kept talking and explaining Ron Paul and everything all through the spring, and then he went paranoid. He decided that we had a lot of money. And he was losing money at the station, so he demanded demanded James to give him a lot of money to support his cause. And James didn't have the money to do it. He was deluded on us. And so we couldn't do it, so he got mad. And by the end of May, he comes on the show, and he starts arguing with me. And he gets so pissed off, he says, I know people in the Secret Service. I am going to have them kill you. Okay? He went paranoid. He flipped because we weren't giving him the emotional support of what he thought, expressed through giving him some money or a loan or something. So after the show was over, James said, John, you've got to go and delete that. You can't say things like that on the radio. You are legally culpable there for that. And so I got my friend to quickly save it, but John did go in and delete him saying that. But we got it on tape, so we always have it. It's right there on my timeline. You can hear this guy losing his cool. So that was like May 28th or something. So we come back on it June 4th, and he invades the thing again. He's not accused. He knows not to say he's going to kill me, but he's accusing me of being part of the elite and all Hollywood bullshit. And so we get through that show. Then on June 11th, he comes on, interrupts, and then he has a tantrum, and he leaves. And he basically says, you're through. You're not here anymore. And we got fired. We weren't allowed on the station anymore. And so for 3 weeks, James looked around, and he found this station called Achieve Radio, which was 8 years old at that point. And it was the first new age digital radio, you know, autonomous of whatever you call that, decentralized internet, where you could have a radio station and be on the internet and get an audience. And so this guy had psychics and astrologers and all these people on there. But James found him, and he convinced him to let us be on his station. And that was 2008. Iron hadn't happened yet. So we get on, and I'm explaining this advanced McLuhanism stuff and Croker stuff, and Bill, the owner, has no fucking clue what I'm saying. We're totally different from all the psychics in that, right? So I got to comment on psychic stuff and satirize them all. So we did that to 9 months, and then Iron showed up, so we put Ion on there. And the first time we put him on, James wasn't sure because he was a guy who had a business of helping people get out of credit problems. And he couldn't, you know, become totally nutty looking because he had a business. So he said, you can't bring on the medium. You can't bring on the astral phenomenon of Ion. And I said, okay, I'll say he's a part of the Secret Council 10 and he knows a lot and we're just going to interview him. So Ion comes on as Ian. Okay, Ian. And so he does a good job for about 50 minutes, and then he may have done it on purpose. He starts saying, you humans have no clue. He started calling everybody humans as if he wasn't one. And so it ended with that sort of little fiasco, but I don't know if anybody noticed it. But it was hilarious from my point of view that he cracked. He didn't get through the whole show with the disguise. So we did that, and then Ion didn't come on for many months, but we were on an L.A. radio, and that's a whole scene. But eventually, James decides that Ion's cool. So we start in October 2009, we start being regular. At first, he had us on for an hour. He had a three-hour slot. And J.W. said, there's a problem here. It seems like it's 5 minutes. It's not long enough. Give us 2 hours. So we convinced James to give us 2 hours. And that still wasn't long enough. So eventually,
this is all still on Achieve Radio.
Yes, and okay. Jim has wondered what the hell's going on here. So eventually, by February 2010, we were on for 3 hours every week. So that was good. And JW felt like it was worth going unconscious, his altered state, and he thought something had got done. It was just a feeling of incompletion before. So we started talking and performing. And we didn't even know what Ion was. It just got wilder and wilder. And Bill, he told me later that he had never heard such con men as us guys. And he said, these are con men, but they are incredible. They make people believe them. He was very impressed with our con. And he had us on the show. Gradually, other psychics and astrologers heard us, and they said, fuck, we're not being associated with those maniacs. So they all quit. And then we ended up, a few years later, being the only thing Bill had. We've kept his station going for the last 8 years. I pay like $30 an hour. Back then it was $20 an hour. So we pay for all the thing that keeps Bill alive. Without us, he'd shut down. But everybody else either died or left. So we drove everybody off, and Bill still, he's on our products. It saved his life a couple of times. He knows we got something going, but he still can't fucking believe it. And he still thinks we're con men at this late stage. So that's the hilarity of the effect of what we did on Achieve Radio, the first new age digital station. Back in 2002 it started. And he was a pilot. So he did crop dusting, you know, flying and fertilizing things.
Mm-hmm.
And so he hung out with a lot of, you know, ex-Vietnam veterans and all that stuff, and CIA people. So he was a hard-edged, tough guy. But he had some psychic experiences, so he thought, okay, let's broadcast this phenomenon because nobody else was doing it. But he got sick of them all. And he tolerates us because we pay, we're efficient, and we keep it going, but he still can't fucking believe it. So
this is going on to this day?
Yeah, that started in October 2009, so it is almost 13 years. And Bill has, you know, had to use suspended judgment, right? He just said, put up with his disbelief and didn't let it bother him. And so he has supported us, and we have endless hours. You never could have a station like we have. We can go as long as we want. There's no commercials, no station ID. We can play all the music we want. He's got a great inventory behind the scenes that I use. I just click on song. It's the freest radio environment ever. You know what I mean? There's no corporate interference at all. And so we have, you can't go on to any network, even 30 years ago, and do 20-hour shows without commercials. Impossible, right? But we get away with it on Bill's thing. So we have created what Peter Lambeau Wilson calls an autonomous, temporary autonomous zone. And it attracts people. Our freedom of expression and the range of what we do attracts people because they can see the fun we have of the autonomy and the freedom of expression. So it's a lot of fun. And so and that energy is what that's the end that is going on. You know, I'm doing with headphones and giving sober analysis among the other noise around me, that and laughing. If you can maintain your poise in that chaos, like Joyce doing Finnegan's Wake, it's an expression of what we're living. Because the Android meme and tech body just keeps going, and nobody can stop it. And it keeps it being a cliche probe, but having this extra energy because it ups the phenomenon from Trump to Biden, two extreme phenomena, right? What would be next? Next would be me in the White House. With IOD, okay? That would be the next extreme AND. And that's what's going on. Overlaying endless. I used to say on the album, it's on the album, we've been improvising and overlaying information on layers of information since 1945. That's when literate history ended.
Mm-hmm. But what you're doing is making explicit what always goes on.
Yes, we are acting the drama of human. Well, McLuhan writes in Catholic Humanism that we figured by the 20th century how to create culture. So we are expressing how culture and reality happens.
Correct. So that's been the theme of our conversation today. The every culture is a hologram, and the seeds of that hologram are holeopathic.
Yes.
And so when you talk about how culture happens, what you're saying is that a certain holeopathic gene or combination of holeopathic genes are activated, and when they unfold, they are a culture.
Yes.
And we are
all living a conscious understanding of the making of culture, even though we wouldn't know, most people couldn't
Correct.
Articulate it.
Yeah, in order to be a human being, we have to understand it in a certain sense.
Yeah.
But up until now, all human beings have understood it in the sense of being of only unconsciously understanding it.
Yes. And now they would need to be conscious, and that's the crisis.
Correct. Correct. Because becoming conscious is extremely painful. That's why nobody wants to do my diagrams.
It's extremely painful.
Yeah, of course.
Right.
Yeah. So Heidegger, for example, said, all being is painful. Why is that? What is the pain that's built into being? The human beings live the tactile gap between the holeopathic genes and the hologrammic
and
world of their experience.
Yeah, the now, and.
When they transfer from the small to the great, they go through an impenetrable darkness. And that impenetrable darkness scares the hell out of people, even though they're doing it every second.
Right, and that's what he says in War and Peace, that the new probe of the 20th century was pain itself.
Yeah.
We explored through pain. And he cites the cardinal who goes to Africa, you know. And
that's right. That's what's so funny about McLuhan is what he always said, I've never experienced any pain. And then he says, except that that's the only thing I ever talk about.
That's right. Like he said, I've never been depressed. I think he even said, I've never even been happy. Does he say that?
Well, he says that happiness is for idiots.
Yeah, he's not concerned about being happy. That's the least of my interests. Which is what everybody else supposedly is trying to get. So he's one of the first to say that, say it that way. Oh, I'm not interested in happiness. Or I'm into suffering, he says.
One of my professors at the University of Alberta in graduate school, Herman Tennyson, wrote an article titled Happiness is for Pigs.
So that is some people would say that's the Christian dynamic, right? That's being a Christian. And now Buddhism says all is suffering, but most Christians don't go around saying that they are exploring pain for discovery. You know, exploring ignorance for discovery. Monks and nuns will celebrate pain. That's what you do when you get that position in the church. But the layman doesn't do that. The layman is sort of looking for happiness from it, for security, for comfort. And McLuhan would, among the laymen, would not accept that. He was a shit disturber. You know, hey, buddy, you're being feeling too comfortable here.
Mm-hmm. But every one of these words that we're using, you know, the Christian, the Buddhist, the layman, all of this stuff, every one of these words only has meaning within a certain context. And so, when we say within a context, what do we mean? Well, what we mean is within a hologram that's been generated holopathically.
Yeah.
So then, so in order to make sense, as opposed to just talking nonsense, that is inherently comic, but also inherently depressing, we have to talk about these processes of cosmic generation.
Yes, I now recall another common statement said to friends of mine who hear me on the radio and like it and all that. They say, Bob, the only person out there who's telling you extremely bad news while laughing and enjoying yourself. There's another dynamic, right? There's a split.
Yes, sir. Well,
that's
the way it is.
Yeah. The exuberance, what is it? The Fed chairman said irrational exuberance?
Yeah.
Alan Greenspan, right. He's the guy who said that.
Right.
Irrational exuberance. Yeah. And he was correct. The economy was the endless and. Irrational exuberance is what was going on.
Yeah, and it's going on right this second.
Yeah. We're doing it, and the whole world is. And journalism, which is now the establishment, like the medieval oligarchy or the aristocracy, was obsolete, you know, as the printing press and mercantilism came in. And so they were holding on the fort and it was a losing battle. That's what journalism is. They're the aristocrats of the old analog media, and they're useless, hopeless, and hated, but they're stuck there as the priesthood. of
yes.
Go ahead. What?
Oh, nothing. I was agreeing with
yeah,
you.
Yeah, the priesthood. There's this a guy named Klein and Lior, the Israeli person, she posted this interview. So Klein is a reporter and for CBS or something. And he has a talk show. So he has on a journalist. And they get on there, and they decided that Neil Post and Marsh McLuhan are the most accurate people from the 20th century of describing the dilemma us journalists are in. So the journalists discussing journalism and the problems. And they go through a very inadequate talk about McLuhan. And basically, they just know the medium is the message, right? They just know that line. And they think that was incredible. And Neil Postman, they think Neil Postman's better at it than McLuhan. So it's just all, what do you call it, inbred, insular New York nonsense. But the funny thing is they start describing the problems, and they say Trump discovered that you could use rage as a negative thing. If you got bad publicity, the people would like it, right? And so mm-hmm. Trump, and so as journalists who were there to say, well, there's all this information, here's the good stuff and that's the bad stuff, well, the audience is playing a game on the journalists and flipping it, so they can't decide what's good or bad anymore. So they're useless. And they discuss this. And so Lior comes on and posts, boy, this is a real train wreck in terms of talking about McLuhan. And so I listened to him. I said, no, Lior, this is fantastic because they're honest. And they describe the dilemma of being a journalist. I'll send it to you. You should listen to it. It's very their own agony of how they realize they're fucking obsolete really badly, mm-hmm. you know?
Well, it's what I think you're describing here is the journalists realizing that they're doing a replay of pro wrestling.
Yes, and it's not fun, and it's backfiring. No matter what they do, it backfires on them.
Yeah.
They can't get any pride.
But that could be used, right? I mean, that's what you realize that everything you do backfires.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I celebrate it.
Yeah.
And you know, I it is very funny. So Ian gets on there and says, he's gradually built me up through the years. He says, now Bob's in charge. He's the boss, but he has no idea what he's talking about or what he's in charge of. And he's constantly making remarks about my incompetence, which I'm laughing at and you know, licking up and enjoying this put down of me. Right?
Absolutely. I don't know too much about what Ian says about you, but what you're reporting here is
exactly
correct.
Yeah, it's damn hilarious. Michael, longtime listener, says, I don't think anybody has laughed as much as Bob's laughed the last 13 years with Ian. There's been a lot of laughter.
Well, there always is with you, Bob.
Yes, it's always I used to say I have a sunny disposition. You know, once this professor told me, he said, Bob, wipe that inane grin off your face. So.
Yeah, why should I?
Yeah, come on now, man. Don't you understand the tactility of this situation? What's tactility, Bob? I don't know, but it doesn't have any content. And we're all tactile. I know that. We've extended it. So, McLuhan gives you lines to say things further than what people had said. He adds something to it. Just to his statement, I don't know what I think until I say it. You know, things like that no one had said. So he found ways to say nonsense and have meaning for it.
Mm-hmm.
What was considered nonsense?
He, at least in my view, McLuhan understood what had the potential for infinite probing.
Yes.
So when he says stuff, then he's not even remotely trying to say something definitive. He's trying to say something that will bear examination forever.
Well, I think I've told you this. The most startling thing, one night in the Monday seminar, he's talking to a professor, and I'm standing there listening to them talk. And the guy was going on and explaining stuff, and then he stopped and waited for McLuhan to praise him or something or to comment. And Marshall says, you're trying to tell me something. And the professor stared at what? And McClure just kept looking at him, and that was the point. It was all phatic, and the guy didn't know it. And Marshall said, "You're trying to tell me something," as if something could be said verbally. Fantastic. A great statement. I never told you that before? That's new?
No, that's funny.
Yeah, it's incredible.
And I like your use of the word phatic.
Yeah.
In that conversation.
You know how he uses the phrase?
No, in your description of it, you use
yes,
right?
Yes.
Because, in other words, the key thing in what was said was what was not said.
That's right. And there's this article when McLuhan died, I think it is, the guy at Ramparts, he knew McLuhan well, and he tells the anecdote that Marshall's talking at the table in the diner. Maybe there's the topless person, that whole scenario. And Tom Wolfe and that are there. And somebody speaks up and says, "Marshall, you go on and on and on and say the same thing." I think it was Gossie. Somebody like that got irritated with him. Says, "Don't you ever have anything else to talk about?" And McLuhan says, "Well, that's what I meant when I didn't say it." And the guy remembered that. He was blown away. "That's what I meant when I didn't say it." I use that often. People say, "Well, you left out all this stuff." And I said, "Well, that's what I meant when I didn't say it." It's a great line. But the the phatic point, he has the phrase macroscopic gesticulation in War and Peace. The global cultures are macroscopically gesticulation. That's a way. Right. That's another way of either phatic communion or manipian phatic is what he's pointing out to. Macroscopic gesticulation is a global phatic interplay, and he makes phatic communion a very important phrase in his first essay on Joyce in 1953 in The Interior Landscape. Phatic communion is really important, and, you know, that came from a guy named Malinowski, an anthropologist, who met I.A. Richards and Ogden in 1922, and they were putting together the book The Meaning of Meaning, and he just came back from, Pacific Island native things, and he reports a bunch of stuff, and they're so blown away. He said, "Wait a minute, we got to have you do an appendix or after statement." And so they held up the publication of The Meaning of Meaning so he could put in his essay explaining how these tribal people did phatic. He named phatic communication.
Right,
that's
right.
Where it came from.
That's the Trobriand Island.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, so that's what you're saying there is all correct.
Yeah.
And at the same time, that was 22, I believe in 1919 already, T.S. Eliot had talked about communication that happens beyond the words.
You mean before poetry is before understanding, that sentence?
Yeah.
Yeah. And
this is...
Yeah, they were all picking up on it.
Phatic communication.
Yes, and so James Joyce and Marcel Duchamp both declared that book very important to them, The Meaning of Meaning.
Interesting.
Yeah, and they were both friends of Peggy Guggenheim. And her best friend married Joyce's son. Forget her name. But they're all part of the same circle in Paris, Joyce, Duchamp, and Peggy Guggenheim. She would host them. She was the rich girl from New York. But that in that circle is where the idea of phatic communion came out of, through Mr. Trobriand Islander.
So that's right when that's the end of Ulysses and when – Joyce is trying to decide what he does next.
Yeah.
And this whole idea that you can communicate beyond the word, which is what McLuhan was saying to that guy that was explaining everything to him in the seminar.
Yeah.
But I guess that's one way of thinking about Finnegan's Wake.
Definitely.
You don't understand what the hell is going on here, but something is communicated to you.
Right, like people cannot not communicate, no matter what's going on. They're always communicating.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so we live in a resonance. that we can partially pass on ourselves, but the deep resonance is communication.
Yes, and so a big influence on Joyce, the Richard Ellman say, was this Jesuit priest, Mr. Jousse, J-O-U-S-S-E, and he was a father, and he talked about the role of gesture as the ground of all communication, and that was really important for Joyce. He applied that. So the gesture is like phatic. Like, remember McLuhan says, I love the way he nods. He really communicates. That's a gesture when you nod, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's what they're getting at, this most intimate level of communication that's always been going on and even gets mixed up with ESP, or ESP is really that. So Joyce said gesture comes before semantic overlay. And that's what McLuhan says about Gertrude Stein. She was trying to show the gestures underlying semantic overlay. That's what he says in Counterblast.
And that's what your laughing is.
Yes, I'm totally instinctively get that since I was a kid.
Well, everybody does.
Yes.
It's just a question of how conscious they are of that instinct.
That is probably the childish. They all celebrate the child's this or that, but that's the children have a sense of the absurdity of something and how do you keep playing within it. That's the spark that people lose. They become serious. They forget the absurdity of it. I mean, I remember in an early interview with Zappa, he says, it's absurd to being alive. And so not many people would say that. Maybe a Samuel Beckett would, but he said it in one of his first interviews. That's correct. That's a good thing to point out. It's absurd being alive, and it is. It's ineffable. You can't you can't fucking express what it is. He only laughed.
You see, the existentialists took absurdity to be something regrettable, something painful, something terrible.
Yeah.
But absurdity is something funny, something that we ended up in a room we didn't even notice a door.
Right. And I think someone defines laughter as a reconciliation of yes and no. That's why it's a pleasure. It actually solves the situation.
That's good. Yeah.
So let's end with that point. We've been going for a couple hours.
That's fine.
So we had a good conversation there.
Yeah. Well, as you usually say that I talk too much and you didn't talk enough. Tonight you talked more than I did.
Yes, and we got into the laughter part, which was good.
That's
you picked
right.
up on the laughter level.
Yeah.
Okay, great. And, I always saw that twinkle in McLuhan. You see it, you know that summer of 68 when he's on a panel with Mailer, Fulford, and himself, and Muggeridge?
Yeah.
In that dialogue, boy, do you see him slyly twinkling at a lot of the times. He's not saying that much. I remember my friend got really upset that McLuhan didn't say enough, but look at his face. He's smiling at the absurdity of these four experts that everybody's listening to. And from his point of view, they weren't doing too well at communicating what was going on. But you see the twinkle in his eyes. Have you ever seen that? You know what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah,
I do. Yeah. He's exercising fatticism.
Fatticism, did you say?
Yeah, the fatic.
Yeah. He's a fatic, and he gets the absurdity. So he kept his childhood sensitivity.
True enough.
Yep. Okay, well, lots of luck to us in maintaining that cruise. And
yes, sir.
Keep going here. All right. Thank you very much. What's your name again? Who am I talking to? Okay. Talk to you later, Cameron.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah.
Ciao,
bye.
Bye.